wildlife and its habitat cannot speak. So we must. And we will.
You're listening to the Conservation Federation of Missouri podcast. Here's Executive Director Brandon Butler.
Turkey season started off pretty cold this year, but I was excited to have some guests in from far away. Joining me today on the podcast is Stephen Ranella and Giannis Patelis.
Giannis Poudlis.
If you're the last person left that doesn't know who these two guys are, they're the Meat Eater crew. Steve is a noted author and writer, as well as speaker to a lot of conservation organizations across the country, and he's the host of the Meat Eater TV show and podcast. Giannis is the producer of the Meat Eater and a longtime former hunting and fly fishing guide out west.
That's right.
Real hardcore sportsman. So, guys, thanks for coming to Missouri and experiencing our coldest opening day of turkey season so far in my memory. But
is that right?
It ended pretty
well. It was unusual?
Unusual.
Felt unusual.
It felt like December. But for it to be, 29, 30 degrees when we went out on opening morning, I was a little nervous when we started off that way Monday and there was no goblin going on, and thinking you guys are going to be a little disappointed in the way this turkey season worked out.
99% of the birds, I think, had their vocal cords frozen.
Yeah, but it turned around on day two, and we got into some birds. Although, Giannis, you killed a bird on day one. So Steve,
that's right.
And I,
that's why I said 99%.
99%, yeah. Steve and I walked and walked and walked and never even heard a gobble, but you started off pretty good. You had, what, a one-hour Missouri turkey season?
Exactly. I think you could say I lucked into it big time. I mean, I had to walk a ridge and a half and, call probably 10 notes on my diaphragm and kill the bird.
Can you walk us through the hunt?
Yeah, you bet. I went, we started pretty much at daylight. We weren't out there that early, but pretty much at daylight. And it was you, Steve, myself, and we kind of just parked the four-wheelers at a spot that you know to start. And you guys kind of headed on up the ridge, and you told me to check out these two ridges. And I went down one and it wasn't really going to pan out because I hit private property pretty soon. And just not knowing kind of how not knowing anything about the locale, I decided to, instead of flirt with the private property boundary, I would just go the other direction. And as soon as I got on the other ridge, heard a bird gobbling, and it was faint at first. It was windy that morning too. And eventually, made it down the ridge and figured it was definitely a gobbler and peeled off the ridge towards him, had to cross a deep holler to get to him. Yeah, if you're not from around here, a holler is a drainage
or
a creek bottom, a valley, a draw. There's nobody hollering down in there when you get there. But this bird was gobbling good on his own. And so I was able just to keep tabs on him and work my way slowly to him. And by the time I crossed the creek, he kind of quit gobbling. So I had to hoot at him once and made sure he was still there, and got on the same ridge as him. I wasn't out of the creek maybe 20, 30 yards. And he gobbled again, and he was close enough for me to say, you better just sit down. And I sat down, set up, made one call. I don't think he heard me. At least he didn't respond. I made another call a little bit louder. And he was there in 2 minutes. And then, although he didn't see the hen, at that point he started strutting and gobbling and gave me the full show as he came in. So I got to watch him for maybe 2 or 3 minutes as he came in doing his thing. And I shot him about 20 yards. It was 7:15 in the morning on opening morning.
You were saying you just sat in the woods for a while?
Oh, I didn't.
Before you walked over to the turkey.
I looked at my watch. Because I've come to do that. It's kind of a nice thing to know when stuff goes down, especially later when you meet up and they're like, oh, yeah, we thought that was your shot at 7:15. So I bet I sat there for 15 minutes just kind of like, holy shit, can't believe that happened. That's not going to happen again like that for a while, and just soaking it in. And then once I went and got the bird, I realized I could then finally see the topography that he was hanging out on. And I got on the ridge and just basically sat there admiring my bird and listening, thinking I'd do some scouting for you guys. I sat there for probably an hour and never heard another gobble.
It didn't go so smooth for you, Steve. What were you thinking about 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday?
Just cold, man. Cold, miserable. It was funny, Giannis, we woke up in the morning and Giannis asked if I was going to wear long johns. And I said, yeah, man, sitting out in the woods against some tree. He goes, you put it that way. pulled his long johns on.
I've got a few spots that are generally good producers. And man, we hit all of them. Giannis's spot was one of those, but we never even heard that bird. Normally, when the wind's not blowing 20 miles an hour, you could hear that bird from where we started off. But, you know, you kind of walked into that goblin, yeah. and we never even heard it. We continued up on the ridge until we just couldn't take the wind anymore, and we bailed off, got down into a drainage, and started working our way back. After that, I peeled out of that part of the country and hit a few more spots, but we never struck a bird. We went the whole day without hearing a gobble.
Yeah, when I'm doing that kind of stuff, like just blind calling or whatever, I try to remind myself of times when you've been real surprised. You know, like those moments in hunting where you're like, can you believe it? Like the last day, man, you know? So I try to keep in mind situations in my life when like the completely unexpected happens and try to harness that enthusiasm in order to sort of remind yourself. Or I'll visualize a turkey coming through the woods, man, to help like keep you fired up. You know, help keep you thinking. Because sometimes it just seems like this is not going to happen.
I feel like that's how it was on Monday. Mm-hmm. Like, I just kept feeling like this isn't going
to
happen.
But you don't want to be a quitter.
Oh, no. You got to go.
So you try to find some way to feel good about it. But when I was years ago, my brother, when we would be hunting elk, you know, and he just like gets so frustrated, man. And like day after day after day. And he, like kind of our mantra became, man, it just takes one. It just takes like one to mess up, you know. And so you stick out there.
But what a difference a day makes. On day two, we woke up and we actually struck a bird from the driveway, from the front porch.
From your house.
Yeah. And every spot that I had thought would be good on day one that let us down was full of birds on day two. And I was able to get a bird with a friend of ours, Parker Hall, also from Missouri. And it was one of the most memorable hunts I'll ever have. I mean, this bird actually flew the river, and watching it glide into a gravel bar and killing a public land bird that way, it was pretty special. But you guys got into birds on day two as well. And, you know, the reason that I was so excited for you guys to come here is because we are hunting public land. And, you know, we're in the Midwest, which is debatable, I suppose.
Some folks call it the South.
would you say when it's hollers and cricks?
Yeah, when you're down in a holler, I feel like it's like you can't be in the North. You're not in the Midwest.
So I've had a unique experience in life to have grown up in the Midwest and moved out West, learned, I kind of got a PhD in public lands while I was out there, and then returned to the Midwest to raise my family and started hunting public lands, really applying what I learned out West to what's available here. And down in the Ozarks, there's huge chunks of public land. And one, I kind of feel an obligation to help this part of the country along. I think it's under recognized for how amazing it is. And I know having you guys here is going to help shed a little light on that. But also I want people to understand the public land opportunities that we have. And not only the opportunities, but the fact that we have public land fights to protect our opportunities to hunt these lands and to have these lands in perpetuity for future generations. It's not just a Western issue. You know, it's an American issue.
Right.
And you guys are really at the forefront of working on protecting those lands, and all the things you do for conservation and conservation organizations has just, you know, made me real appreciative of your efforts. So,
yeah, man, growing up in Michigan, though, we ran around on public land all the time. I grew up at the southern end of what's now the Huron Manistee National Forest. It used to just be the Manistee. It got administratively, you know, combined. But you know, the way our perspective on it was that it fell from the sky, man. We never put any thought into how it came to be, management challenges, funding issues. It was just like we just took advantage of it without any consideration for, right? See, without any consideration for, like, being an advocate for it. You know, it was just like this like freebie playground is how everybody viewed it. No, I wasn't aware of anyone talking about issues around, you know, how do we protect this space? How do we, you know, get the most out of it? Make sure it's providing the greatest value to the most people. There's just land. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now I've come to view this stuff as not quite so fixed in time as I once did.
Growing up in Northern Indiana, public land is just incredibly scarce. And all the horror stories you hear about public land and how crowded it can be and overrun with hunters, that's what I got to see. I mean, there was a stretch near Winnemac, Indiana. There's a fish and game area, and there's a highway that divides the state park and the fish and game area. And on opening day, all these hunters are spreading out about every 50 yards down the face of that public land, trying to get deer that are running out of the state park or towards the state park.
So
you drive down the highway and it's just orange, 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 orange.
I mean, really?
For the whole stretch. And that, as a little kid, you know, 12, 13 years old, when I was really getting going as a hunter, that was my first observation of public land. And it took moving out west to see that that's not what all public land hunting is. So, but you guys do such a good job of shedding light on those opportunities. Your show is incredibly adventurous. You know, I was talking to Parker and he's like, man, that outdoor hunting shows, they're just not for me. And I said, that's what's so cool about these guys is they've created a hunting show for people who don't really like hunting shows. And it's, I think, the adventures and kind of the intellectual depth that you go to, but you do it in a way that's not off-putting and it's not kind of in your face. It's just more matter of fact. Like, here's all these opportunities that we do, but you guys can do them too. Was that kind of always your vision when you got into outdoor television, or did it just kind of evolve naturally?
I get asked that a fair bit, but I wasn't responding to anything. I think a lot of people, you know, in conversation will ask me like, well, was this you reacting against trends in outdoor television, or was this meant to be kind of a, you know, a new way to do outdoor television? I honestly did not, and to a large extent, you know, I almost hate to say this, to a large extent, do not watch outdoor television. Not because I don't like it, because I just, there's a limited amount of time and I don't feel that I'm going to do my job better by taking in that information. I'd rather take in other information. Right. So I read a lot of anthropology. I read a lot of history. I watch a lot of documentaries. I watch a lot of films from people that I think are like really good filmmakers who are dealing in other genres. Right. Cause I'm interested in that stuff. And when I got into doing a show about hunting, all I was trying to do was to some extent capture hunting as I understood it or as I liked it most. And also to show about the kinds of things I did and to show the kind of things I dreamed about doing. And I didn't come at it, and the guys that I worked with and kind of like laying out what the show would look like. And you got to understand, it's a collaborative effort, right? But I mean, so there's many different people's imprints get put on it, but it was never as like a screw you to something. It was just trying to do to get something right. Something that I felt was like, done in a way that I would be proud of. And so that it wound up being something that a lot of people view as being really unusual in terms of outdoor TV is kind of accidental. But I think if you want to shoot for something that's original, emulation isn't going to get you there. There's an exception, I would think, to that in writing. And I know you like to write. In writing, if you read really great writers and you're not as smart as they are, and you're not as talented as they are, and you try to write like them, it's not going to work. But in doing that, you might think of something original because your imitation of them is so wildly far off that it winds up hitting way off at the fringes of the target, but is kind of unusual. And so you can make a style up by trying to mimic someone you have no right mimicking. And I used to read a lot of writers, and I was like, man, I'm going to write like that, but kind of like that writer. And kind of like that writer with elements of that writer thrown in. And then you wind up with some, right? Anytime you start mixing that many ingredients together.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And now that I think about it, you know, I think your writing and your dedication to the story. And I think that's what's different about the show is that every episode is a real story. It's not $3 go down and, you know, we did it with our blah, blah, blah gun and blah,
putting
blah,
the smack blah. Down on
yeah,
box.
You didn't smoke them and,
closing the coffin.
I can speak a little bit to that too. And, I didn't have a production background when I met Steve and 0.0 when I started working with Meat Eater and 0.0. So I kind of learned on the fly about, you know, what is television production and what is narrative storytelling. And I just can still remember when we were on a shoot, it was with Mo and Dan, I think, up at your fish shack.
And they're like, yeah, you need to start thinking about how the act structure is going to break down for this episode. And I was like, excuse me, what does that mean? You know? And, but I think that there was a certain way that outdoor television was done for a very long time. And it's not that I don't, the ZPZ and Steve didn't try to do it differently. It's just that 0.0 wasn't doing outdoor TV. They've been doing just normal TV. And I think if you look at the rest of entertainment, there's a lot of people that produce in a, you know, quality narrative storytelling form, and they do a good job at it. I just don't think that that had necessarily been applied to, you know, in the hunting genre.
So yeah, we knew, but like people, we worked with people that came up through doing like basically a travel log.
I tell people who aren't familiar with the show that aren't really in hunting that you should watch this show. And they're like, well, what's it like? And maybe you'd agree or not, but I always tell them it's similar to Anthony Bourdain's show in the sense that it's always a story about a place and an experience, and there's education involved in it. And it's, you know, it's like a, it is, it's a, not only a hunting show, but it's a travel show. There's a lot of personal stories involved in it. And I just think it does so much to respect not only the animals, but the traditions and the places that you guys go and the different cultures that you experience along the way. But Yanni, I was thinking you were a guide kind of during the explosion of outdoor television. Mm-hmm. Did you witness that in like the different mentalities of hunters? Did you see any kind of evolution in the way these people are showing up over that period of time?
That's like directly correlated to what was going on in hunting TV.
Just that you would see like this correlation to more like product involvement and the way people approached really the whole experience.
You know, I don't think so.
Yanni used to go to Walmart to check in.
Yeah, to buy the latest, you know, truth about big bulls or whatever I forget the exact title of Primos's, you know, elk hunting DVDs, but, yeah.
But that's not really hunting TV. That's like different.
Yes. You know, I think they had a show based around it too.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. But
yeah. I mean, that chest over there, I've probably got 50 different hunting DVDs and stuff. And when I was younger, mm-hmm. I was into it, man. And then I got into the industry and I think I got a little too close to it. Mm-hmm. But I also think it got saturated. I think it was pretty good to start off. I mean, at least it was headed. I mean, it was always headed in this like NASCAR of hunting sort of mentality of sponsors and logos to an extreme.
But that's just how that stuff was funded. It's not like, it's not like people that make shows are, it's not like that's their aesthetic.
But what you guys do,
it's just like, it's just the reality. It's like,
you don't put that in people's faces so much.
No. And we wound up working with companies that were cool with that and weren't able to work with companies that weren't cool with that. But I think that people that are making infomercial type hunting shows, it's just the reality of how that industry works, man. Yeah. So when you're watching, I don't know if a lot of people realize this, like if you're watching today, one of the two primary hunting and fishing networks or hunting networks, the bulk of the shows on there are not paying those people to make those shows. The network is not paying people to make those shows, like how every other show you watch in any other network works. What happens is, The producer of the show is buying the slot. They're buying a 30-minute window of time on the network. So it's a completely ass-backwards system. And you can see what's going to happen to your level of quality in such a system, where a person has to make a cash outlay to get the speck of time and then has to go find a way to recoup the money on their own. And so you wind up, you know, you're in a situation where you strike deals with, you know, these sponsors or companies, and oftentimes the companies can have a very rigid sense of what they're looking to get out of it. And it winds up being that people have to spend an inordinate amount of time plugging wares. And I think that what falls apart on their end and what falls apart on the sponsor's end is that you can hit a point where it's not effective as a selling tool. But I'm very reluctant to criticize someone who makes a show where they're trying to sell products, because if that's what they like to do and have always dreamed of doing that and want to make those shows and they have to find a way to pay for it, it's just the reality, man.
Yeah, but where it goes off the tracks for me is when the people that buy the show, you know, they're essentially buying it with the idea that they're going to be famous. Like they're not into it because they want to educate people, or they're not into it because, you know, they're trying to do something that's positive for conservation, or, you know, any what I personally would consider the right reasons.
Yeah. It's a way to get on TV. It's the quickest way to, it's like doing that model is the quickest way. Like,
if I had a dollar for every time I heard somebody tell me, you know, it's the most revolutionary show that we're going to do. And this is when I was taking pitches for sponsorships in a previous job, and people that think they're going to be the next Michael Waddell, you know, and it just wore me out. But that's why I think your show is so refreshing to me and to so many people who follow what you guys do. It's just, it's different. And, you know, I'm just really thankful that you guys continue to put it out, and the quality at which you do it, and the conservation messages, especially that you put out. So thanks for that. And what season are you guys going into now? And
well, we just finished, we filmed the last of what'll be season 7 in October of last year. And, we're working right now to finish those edits, and that's 16 shows.
Can you tell us what some of those shows are going to be? Just a couple of your favorites.
Tell you what they all are.
Well, a couple favorites. We did a, flying moose hunt, and my dad got to come along, which was, super sweet.
It was his dream to go on a, like a wilderness moose hunt.
Yeah.
Got a big old bowl.
Steve was thinking we should have taken him. What were you saying? Caribou instead, maybe?
Yeah.
I forget. Caribou. My dad was like,
just to watch hundreds of something go by in a day, right? Like when people want to see something really like that you'll never see again.
The caribou migration?
Yeah, if you catch it.
I want to see that someday.
It's pretty incredible, man. You get kind of a day into it, you kind of got to remind yourself what you're looking at.
Any of that coming up in the next season?
Yeah. The second half of season 7 has a caribou hunt. We took our buddies Mark Canyon and Doug Duren. They're both from the Midwest. Had never hunted Alaska. Maybe never even been to Alaska.
Oh, Doug fishes at my shack.
Yeah, down in the southeast. Mm-hmm. But so we went to the interior, to the Alaska range, and yeah, witnessed possibly 1,000 animals a day, you know, on the landscape. It was pretty special. What else? Mountain lion hunt in Idaho is super exciting.
South America.
Yep. Guyana.
Traveling with, doing a river trip with some Makushi guys and some other guys. I think were Wapishan, but these are guys that grew up. So when they were, I mean, they're younger than me, some of them, kind of my main guy I know down there. I've done a couple of trips with. He's younger than me by a good stretch. He grew up going up this river in a homemade dugout canoe with his family to go hunt and fish in order to salt the meat when they needed money, cash money, in order to salt the meat, where they would spend, I think it'd take them 10 days or 2 weeks to get out the river to the fishing grounds.
Yeah.
In a dugout, they'd fish for a week until they had, I can't remember, 500 or 700 pounds of salted fish, paddle down past their village, up another river, hire an ox cart, haul the ox cart in a couple miles to a village to sell that fish for $75.
That's crazy.
He's now a river guide who takes people into those ancestral fishing grounds that they have for thousands of dollars.
So he's made an
probably per day
incredible career out of this,
to the point where it's like, to the point where I think that it would be like, you know, we talk about in our culture, like coming into the nuclear age, or coming into the internet age, how sort of like culturally upsetting it is. Mm-hmm. I think that they're in that, like that his village is in that equivalent. Mm-hmm. With the discovery of, you know, Westerners who are like, holy shit, you do what? Can I come?
Yeah.
I'll pay for everything.
So that shows just how far apart different places in the world are, you know, what we're worried about and what they're worried about don't even compare.
No, he's worried about a shaman who put a curse on the herd of white lip peccaries that live near his stuff, and how they need to get their shaman to get good enough to defeat that shaman in a shamanistic battle in order to unlock the peccaries, which he believes are locked up into a mountain. And also his satellite internet connection is fucking with him. Those are the two, like when he's like, that was the two chores he had on his checklist.
So when you traveled all these places, I mean, from something that, you know, off the grid and remote to Michigan, Montana, Alaska, what are some of the common threads that you see? Like, there's so many differences, you know, in the hunting cultures of Michigan to Montana, Montana to South America. Like, when you meet these people all over the world, like, what are some common threads that you find in folks
amongst all these outdoors folks?
Yeah.
Oh man, that's a tough one, because we've been working on that edit for Guyana, and you really, it's hard to pull out the common threads. You really see all the stark differences. For instance, Steve continually was asking our buddy Rovan, like, he was asking about, like, on a scale, how do you like to eat this fish, or how do you like to eat this animal? And Rovan couldn't conceptually understand the question. He was just like, this one's easy to catch. I eat this one in August because that's when it's around. And he didn't ever have like a, oh, this is better than this, or this is an 8 on a scale of 10. He just like doesn't think that way.
Even with work. You know, we run around all day. I like this better than that. I like this better than that. And this is sucks and that's good. You say, like, what do you like better? I'll be like, what do you like better? They kind of have a crop they grow.
Cassava root.
Cassava. It's called maniac in some places, I think.
Yeah. They chew it, right?
No. It's their starch.
What's that stuff they chew?
These guys, the Makushi, don't, but coca leaves in some areas in South America, and then in some places, like in Asia and maybe others, betel nut. And then in Africa, cut, K-H-U-T, it's all this like mild stimulants that people have. But these guys, I never saw those guys chewing coca leaves.
No.
Bolivia, they chew coca leaves like you wouldn't believe. We took up the habit down there, but it doesn't do anything to you.
I saw that. That's
I thought it'd like mess you all up. It's like, holy cow, that's what they make cocaine out of, you know?
Yeah.
Dude, you pack your mouth so full of those leaves, you still wouldn't be able to tell.
Nothing, huh?
I couldn't.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's...
I kept trying to feel it, but I couldn't feel it,
man. It's similar to like taking a jar of bay leaves and packing them in your lip and then waiting to see what happens.
And a while later, you'd be like, yeah, I'll just have some coffee. So what were we talking about?
Common threads. So maybe that's too extreme.
Oh yeah, but I wanted to finish that thought about the relative stuff. It's just funny that they don't, like, I'd be like, do you like farming maniac or fishing better? Well, I have to do both. But what do you like better? I do both. So you don't get more excited, you know what I mean? It's like, it's fishing, man, and isn't it exciting? I just do both.
Something they have to do.
It's just, yeah, but it's not a joyless life.
So they're not down there debating like what fights harder, a smallmouth or a brown trout.
Nope. I guess we have found, though, is, speaking of common threads, that at least run around North America, and I think it's this little, you know, web that we've built, and, you know, we hang out with you for 3 days and then you introduce us to someone else. And the next time we come this way, we're down in Arkansas and we meet just another great person. But a general, like a happiness and a positive attitude amongst everybody that's just like involved in what we're involved in. Like, a lot of times we didn't know you from Adam until, you know, 3 days ago. I mean, maybe Steve did a little bit more than I did, but, you know, you come down here and you leave with like three new good friends, right? And it seems like that happens over and over and over. And I wonder, is it just coincidence or is it because of what we're kind of involved in?
No, because it winds up being that it's this web of contacts and people.
Yeah.
And I think that if someone just had a horrible reputation, we would catch wind of it.
Yeah. They don't have any a-holes that they're going to like introduce us to.
Yeah. So everything, there's a kind of a flow to all that. And then like the common thread too is, you know, different editors, like people don't realize an editor has a huge impact on a show. Everyone that touches it, like, changes it. But an editor has, like, the person that sits down on all that footage, what's the ratio?
We usually shoot 100 to 1. Yeah, so when you see 22 minutes of television, that means we shot 200.
No.
2,000, sorry.
Yeah, 100. So
100, that's a lot of filming.
Yeah. So it takes, well over an hour to get a minute.
Wow. And you guys are lugging this gear all over, into the backcountry. I mean, what's that like? Does it take a whole, you got a whole team with you lugging this stuff around? Or
Well, I didn't. I was going to make a point there about, the editor has a big impact on it, but there are certain, like, you might not really, if you start paying attention, if you watch a bunch of the episodes and you're paying attention, you'll see that there's a way that we make them, you know? There's like, one, they're all, it's a four-act structure, so it's 22 minutes of content. You know, the first act is the longest. The last act's the shortest. There's always, there's an intro that kind of grabs you by the boo-boo, right? Then you come in and up at the top of the first act, we're going to kind of lay the land. Where are we? What's going on? Who's here? Right? Kind of try to establish a theme. The second act is going to be, you know, really in the meat. The third act's going to lead up to a sort of resolution of sorts. Every time you act out, you're acting out on something where you're kind of like, stay tuned for more, right? Something pivotal happens. You roll into the fourth act and it's kind of conclusion-y. So it doesn't matter, you know, you could be fishing catfish in Kentucky, which is one of the favorite episodes that I've done, or squirrel hunting in Kentucky, which is another favorite of mine. Or you can be, right, paddling around in South America, fishing for things you didn't even know existed till it comes up out of the water. And when you put it all together, that it's going to turn into sort of a product that kind of feels like a recognizable thing. So it's like taking this sensibility and taking a sensibility and an aesthetic, and as weird as they are and different as they are, kind of cramming them into like a certain shaped box, right? That winds up making them feel like the show. And that, I think, is when people come to sit down to something, they want it to be new and fresh, but they kind of want to know what they're getting into. And so sussing that out is one of the challenges. Is like, how can it be new and fresh, but it still has to be the show?
I think some of my favorite episodes that you guys have done are where you're introducing new hunters. I mean, you've introduced celebrities like Joe Rogan to hunting, who's become an incredible advocate for the outdoors. But you also just took out a group of gals one time, and watching that experience and how cool that must be for them to have you guys as mentors and teachers. What's the drive to do that? What's the drive in both of you guys to try to introduce what you love and know to these new people?
Well, that came about, they weren't just a couple of gals, and you wouldn't know that, but you know, our good friends, Helen and Brittany, and they both worked for the production company. And they, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, came to Steve and were like, hey man, kind of been working on this show for a number of years. We're interested. We want to get into it. And then they decided to make a show around it. And then we had them on twice. Once for the elk hunt was the first time. Mm-hmm. And then we went to Wisconsin and hunted whitetails too. So,
and one of them, she used to be like an anti-hunter, man. When she got assigned to this show, she was like, I'm not working on this. Really? I can't believe we're doing this. That's how. And then she slowly kind of through exposure to it, got more and more interested in it.
I think you guys do that to a lot of people. I think that's what makes the platform so special, is that you're introducing it to them in a way that's understandable, that mm-hmm. it's about the experience and the food. And, you know, it's not all about like your buck isn't as big as my buck. And, you know, I think that's incredibly, incredibly important to your success, is the fact that so many people find that refreshing and are drawn to it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another thing that you guys do so well is the conservation aspect. And I know you're starting to really emerge, Steve, as a speaker at a lot of these conservation organization banquets and such. I think you were recently at Quail Forever. I seen about a dozen of my buddies with photos of them and you together.
And
can you talk a little bit to that, your involvement in conservation organizations and kind of your feelings on where we are in conservation in America today?
Yeah, I think you become sort of aware of the fact that, you know, people are listening to you and looking at what you're doing, you know, in a way that they might, you know, be impacted by you. And that can weigh on you a little bit, where you want to make sure that you're, you know, if you're in that position, you want to make sure that you're doing, you know, as much of a favor or doing it responsibly. With me, I always look like, I'm always asking, like, does it have entertainment value? Right. So Let's take the example of taking our Brittany and Helen out on their first hunt. It's something I wanted to do. It's something I would have done if we didn't have a show. And I did do that all the time. I used to, in fact, do a lot more of that before I was doing a show. I did a lot more taking people out on their first hunts prior than I'm able to do now. So it's something I always cared about. But I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think that it would be a good show. Like, I am, like, making something, right? Making something you want to be entertaining. So it's not just going and being like this sort of this burden of, man, I need to do this. You know, the world won't be set right until I do X. I'm always looking to be like, man, I'd be like, wow, I'd be like a cool story. And this is the other part. And it has to fit with what feels right and natural, but it has to be good, you know? And we'll a lot of times have things we'd like to go do, and we don't debate whether we'd really like to go do it or not. We're always debating, like, would it be good? And sometimes we'll kick an idea around for months or more trying to figure out a way if we could make it good because we really want to go, but we won't go until it's good. And so it's not like, I don't feel like I'm like bending over backwards all the time to accommodate my responsibilities, right? I feel it comes pretty natural. As far as being involved in conservation groups, there's a handful of groups who, you know, I really believe in their mission, and there are places where I feel like I could have, you know, a positive effect and actually like move the needle in some direction on their behalf by getting involved with the stuff. And there, it also feels like it just makes like a rounder, fuller thing to have it be like, if we're going to spend a ton of time talking about the outdoors and a ton of time celebrating the resources and the adventure of it, I feel like part of that story, right, is preserving these landscapes and making sure things are sound. And so it winds up being like, I used to think of the show as being like A to Z, right? Like the A to Z of a hunt, right down to the food at the end. And I just over time started to feel more and more like that conservation message was part of that A and Z process. But it came about pretty slowly as I've had the luxury to travel around and meet so many people and come face to face with so many challenges that we face. Growing up, right, you kind of like have a very isolated view of the world. You know, we did the vast majority of our hunting and fishing within 8 miles of our home for decades, right? You would understand those risks and challenges, but you didn't view them as being part of this like big, broader conversation. So through writing and through traveling around to film the show, you start to, like, I started to develop this more like national scale picture of where we stood with wildlife habitat, cultural issues around hunting. And the more I came to understand this like broad spectrum, like high perspective view on all this stuff, the more I felt like, my God, like I need to be involved in these conversations and push things the way that I would like them to go. But it's like almost like a chicken or the egg thing. Right. Because I had to get exposed to all this before I really started to understand it clearly. You know, I used to have this sense of I loved wilderness and I liked wild places and I hated it when wild places became less wild. But I didn't understand like the mechanics of how it worked. And as I came to understand the mechanics of how it worked, like what needs to happen, who's doing it, who are the enemies, who are the allies, then I started to find ways to be more, you know, to be more effective and actually like bring about some level of change or some level of influence. But it was a very gradual process.
One conservation organization that you support and are involved in is Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And that organization is growing rapidly, but they're growing in a demographic, age demographic and a sex demographic. They have so many female members and their membership is in this like 25 to 50 year old range, very, very heavy in there. And so many other conservation organizations that I talk to, it's such a struggle to recruit both of those. You know, it's hard to get these people that are in the throes of their working years. You know, when you're in your 30s and 40s and you've got families and jobs and, you know, your time is so limited. Little league baseball and soccer and plays and school events, all of that. From your observations, what are they doing so right? And what can other conservation organizations learn from what they're doing.
Man, I think a handful of things, but one of them, I'd be curious to hear Giannis's perspective on it. But one thing I would think of is that right now they have a clearly defined enemy. There's no one out there. You look at a fantastic organization like Ducks Unlimited. Like Ducks Unlimited does the real Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation too, National Wild Turkey Federation too, do like a sort of very real conservation work where DU takes money and buys habitat. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation takes donor money. I mean, they do a lot of things, but one of the things they do, they take donor money, they pool this money up, they identify very important pieces of wildlife habitat in a situation where it's a willing seller and a willing buyer, and they buy that shit up, and then they hand it off to a land management agency to manage it as public property, right? An unassailable mission. It's a fantastic mission. But a thing you don't find is there's not like an anti-elk group, okay? So I feel that right now, with backcountry hunters and anglers being basically public lands advocacy, there are people who hate public lands. There's no one that hates ducks. There's a lot of people who are like perfectly, a version of hatred is ambivalence. And there's a lot of people who are ambivalent toward ducks. But there's no one saying like, I want ducks gone. But with public lands, you have people who just see a very different thing when they look out the window than what I see, who hate public lands. It's like when they look at a piece of public land that's just sitting there with wildlife running around on it, they view it as wasted space. So people can coalesce around this idea that there's like that you're actually like engaged in a battle that's being played out right now in state politics. It's being played out right now in county politics. It's being played out right now in federal politics. It's real, man. And so that speaks to people. There's a lot of other things that they do. That they do right. But I think that that's given like a real sense of immediacy to that mission. When you can open up the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, right? And read articles about, do public lands warrant the energy and money that we put into them? It's like, that shit's real, man. It made it real to me.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, that was going to certainly be my, top pick for a reason, but right along the same lines is because it's a current issue. And to no fault of their own, but like the Turkey Federation, the Elk Foundation, the Ducks Unlimited have been very successful in what they've done. And when there were less elk and less ducks and less turkeys, it was a lot easier to get people fired up to go help out these, animals in need. Now that we see turkeys almost everywhere, elk, so many places. It's harder.
Yeah, thankfully, our Department of Conservation here in Missouri is well funded through a dedicated sales tax that I talked to you guys a little bit about. But they fund a lot of research in Canada. They fund waterfowl research projects and put money into Canada, which is easily understandable to guys like us. Ducks come from Canada,
right?
But we have had just horrible fights over that budget line in the state legislature. You are sending Missouri tax dollars to Canada. Like what?
Yeah, because right now that's where our ducks are, man.
Yeah,
we want to make sure they're well taken care of.
We have to try to explain that, the ducks don't stay here all year long. But so
it's like when your kids go to grandma's, you still expect them to be fed and taken care of.
That's where the advantage of putting your money, your $35 or $40 a year into Ducks Unlimited is there's no politician that can tell Ducks Unlimited that they can't buy up that habitat or they can't work on a project that needs to be done to help sustain our waterfowl populations here come November, December, mm-hmm. January. So I think it's so important to support conservation organizations. And a statistic that I heard at a major deer conference was that less than 1% of deer hunters in America belong to a conservation organization. And I can't
Think about that for a minute.
I can't state where that fact comes from, but it came from that conference, which means some reliable source mm-hmm. spit that out. And in Missouri alone, we have 520,000 unique deer hunters that collectively purchase about 1.3 million tags. So you've got some big numbers of people hunting deer,
right?
But less than 1% of them belong to a conservation organization. And that's on a national average.
So that's weird because like I grew up around like growing up, the guys that my dad hung out with were involved in conservation organizations.
The conservation clubs.
Well, I had to join. I was always a member of Michigan United Conservation Clubs because I sold fur at the Ravana Fur Auction, and you had to be an MUCC member because you had to be in Michigan Trappers Association, and Michigan Trappers Association was an MUCC organization. So you were like, you bought into it, but I grew up going to DU banquets, Michigan, like there was a kind of a weird type of conservation organization, Michigan Steelheaders, which is sort of like a conservation organization for a non-native fish. But that, right. I grew up around people making those spends, you know, but I know tons of people now. I mean, I don't know about the exact, I don't know the statistic you gave. Yeah. I mean, most people aren't involved.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, like most people are not involved.
Yeah.
I mean, but most people don't hunt that much.
People that I'm near and dear to my own heart, my uncle, my cousins, I'd be surprised if they belong to any conservation organizations. And it's like, what are we missing? You know, what do we need to be doing more of to convince these people that what you said, these threats are real? When the wolf's knocking at the door, I think that's what you're saying about backcountry hunters and anglers, is that, you know, that is like an in-your-face issue right now. But to my uncle living in Lake County, Indiana,
isn't feeling it.
He's not feeling it. Like when it gets to his doorstep, that's when people seem to engage. But I, you know, what I do for a living is to try to get people to engage.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think it's like being forced to recognize the finite, you know, occasions where people have to recognize the finiteness of resources gets people involved. But even then, the American conservation movement took hold at the worst of times. So maybe because we have it relatively pretty good right now, maybe people feel like, I don't know what's really going to happen. Like if you like to go down and fish catfish out of the river now and then, every time you go down there, there's some catfish in the river. And maybe it's not quite as good as when grandpa was alive, or maybe it's a little better when grandpa was alive, but it's just like, you just like to fish catfish. And some guy rolls up and says, hey man, you should belong and be involved in the conservation movement. And I could be like, I just like to fish catfish, man.
Yeah.
Like the same way that if you go on an annual vacation down to Florida and you're down in Florida on vacation and someone comes and says, hey, you should spend a bunch of money as this group to support this area where you like to vacation. You're like, I'm just here for the day, bro. I mean, I'm here for a couple of days having a good time. I'm not going to get all involved in this. And I think that's the way a lot of people view outdoor resources. They just view it as like, there's your thing that you do. And so I think that's also explains kind of why it is that we have so many conservation organizations that are sort of built around a species specific conservation group. I love to hunt elk. There's a group for me. I love to hunt whitetails. There's a group for me. I like to hunt ducks. There's a group for me. I like to fish trout. There's a group for me. Mm-hmm. And it tends to be that those groups, you miss a lot of stuff, right? There's a lot of species that don't have an advocacy group, but thankfully a lot of those groups that are focused on specific animals that has an umbrella effect and they support a wide variety of things. When you're protecting elk habitat, you're protecting habitat for everything from voles up to wolves, right?
Yeah, that's something I struggle with at the Conservation Federation is people are like, well, conservation's doing pretty good in Missouri. You know, you guys are pretty well funded. I'm like, no, you know, we're not the Department of Conservation. We're an overarching federation of all kinds of different conservationists, from hunters and anglers to parks enthusiasts, bird watchers, wildlife watchers, scuba divers, people who just love to be outdoors and utilizing the natural resources that kind of bind us all together. But when you say, yeah, I love ducks, and like, well, you know what Ducks Unlimited does when you read the title. Same with Trout Unlimited, Elk Foundation, and so on down the line. So I think that's a good point. You touched a little bit on politics, and that's certainly something that we at the Federation deal with a lot. And I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about an interview you recently did with Congressman Rob Bishop, who's kind of at the forefront of this public lands issue that so many of us are concerned about. One, I just want to commend you for taking that approach and the journalistic integrity that comes from what you did. And two, your takeaways from it. What were you left feeling about where he stands and ultimately what his hopes and intentions are?
I think Rob Bishop is a U.S. representative from Utah. He is one of the most, if not the most powerful figure in the country when it comes to natural resources management. He sits on the House Natural Resources Committee. bills and, you know, bits of legislation that deal with those that kind of come to his desk to live or die. He wields an enormous amount of power. I think that he loves his family. I think that he loves his country. But when we look at a patch of ground, we just don't see the same thing, man. I came away from it being, you know, just came away from it with the realization that you need to remind ourselves that it's not oftentimes these battles, as much as you want to think of them as being good versus evil, you need to be smart enough and mature enough to realize that it's not that simple. You're dealing with issues of perception, and you could have, like I said, you could have a good person who, you could have good patriotic people who look at the world and just come away with completely different perspectives on what it needs. And the only really responsible way to engage in that is to engage in it around discussion. Now, if I was a lawmaker, right, I would be on a lot of the issues that we talked about with Rob Bishop. We kind of ran the sort of, you know, conservation roundup about all the various things going on in this country on a national level. If I was another politician, we would be locked in perpetual battle. But I think it was an important discussion to have, to like hear from him where he's coming from, because we would get criticized from our listeners who would say, man, you guys are pounding this all the time, but I feel like you're not doing a good job of representing the other side of it. And at first I might be like, okay, but I'm not interested in the side of this argument that doesn't support protections for wildlife habitat. I'm not interested in the argument that says that we should ditch our public lands and privatize them, or, you know, whatever worst case version of it is. Right. But I felt that, you know, as a thing of respect to our listeners who are calling us out on that, I'm like, okay, you're right. I've been very biased in this. And since you're doing me the favor of listening to all this material and you're venting that piece of criticism, I'll try to write it and go to the, and write in the biggest way possible and go to like the leading voice that I felt like I stood in opposition to.
Well, it's something I certainly understand working with the legislature yearly in Missouri. You know, there's 163 state representatives and 34 senators, and you got to kind of understand how to work with all of them on both sides of the aisle. And there's certainly some folks that are just, you know, worse than others on the issues that we care about. And I've gotten to know those people over time. And as you said, I find them to be decent human beings, but the people that are outside looking in that have never actually sat down and had a conversation with them in their office and talked to them about something other than that one issue that we disagree upon, you know, they like to consider them villains and vilify them. And it makes it hard for everybody involved. It makes it hard for that legislator, because then they start feeling the villain role, and they want to push back harder, I think, at some time. So I don't know. I just feel like in our country at this time, you know, there's so much division and divide, and maybe it's always been that way, and I'm just getting old enough to really understand it and live it. But I just think, you know, you can disagree with people to the core and still not find them to be a bad human being.
Yeah.
Or a bad person.
There are people out there that I do think are bad. There are definitely people out there on the other side of the conservation issues who I do think are bad people, to the point where I don't understand what their vision for America is. Like, I really don't understand it. And I feel that they're coming from a deeply antagonistic space, and they do kind of have and they do kind of look at the natural world and feel uncomfortable about it and dislike it. I do think those voices are out there, and I don't mean to be like super kumbaya about, you know, we just need to all have a bunch of conversations, because there's a lot of really like detailed nitty gritty fighting that needs to go on. But I'm not a policymaker, right? What I can do is I can make entertainment. I can make entertainment that in some way kind of like leads people hopefully to see a perspective on things.
And to engage themselves.
Yeah. And so as part of that whole process, I think you can, to some limited extent, demonstrate two sides of something. I'm able to sit on issues ranging way outside of wildlife or conservation or hunting and fishing. I'm able to look at issues that I care deeply about, and I work hard to get to a point where I could articulate the opposite perspective.
And allowing the opposite perspective to be heard allows people to understand what they're truly fighting against.
Yeah. And it takes tension away. It's like, I think a lot about like detensioning things. And I think that when someone's sitting there and they're like listening to you talk about something and they're like, yeah, but right.
Yeah.
And they get where they want to kill you. I find it's often very effective to be like, hey, listen, bro. I understand the other side of this. Here's what you think. You quite reasonably, you think this, this, and this, and that's a valid perspective. So sit back, relax, and I'm going to now tell you what I think about it. And I think it allows people to just kind of go, oh, man, thank you. And that's the thing, like even to come around like making television shows about hunting, I find I spend a lot of time working on it and watching it and thinking like, what are the things where people are going to be like, what? But what about he didn't? And addressing all those questions so that people can relax and just take it in. Because when I watch TV and I'm watching and I see something that's not quite right, dude, that's all I'm thinking about.
One of the big political battles that we've been in here in Missouri in the last few years is something that I know you've spent a lot of time talking about. You wrote about it in your first book, and that's chronic wasting disease and really the captive cervid industry. And, you know, a lot of that is the high-fenced hunting. For people that don't know what cervids are, that's really the deer family, moose, deer, elk. And the transportation of them is really at the core of what we've been dealing with as far as an issue. You know, can you talk a little bit about your experience working with CWD and trying to educate people about it and kind of your take on the captive cervid facilities and such?
Well, like a lot of people, I'm like deeply, deeply concerned about CWD. It's just, it's mysterious and horrible. And if the disease were to spread for what it means for our deer and elk numbers, it could be catastrophic there. And what it means for food safety, for the safety of wild game, could be catastrophic. I know that there's a lot of guys out there that hunt that don't really care about what happens in the meat. But I think if we got to be where we looked at deer and we looked at venison, not as like this beautiful resource that we want to share with our friends and eat with our families, and we looked at it where we had to kind of be suspicious of it and suspicious of the safety, it's just going to change every aspect of deer hunting in this country, culturally, economically. It's just going to, it could be catastrophic. It could end deer hunting as we've always known it. And the disease moves around, and it moves around inexplicably. It's undeniable that humans moving deer around in the backs of trailers and trucks has helped move chronic wasting disease around. They're moving them around, you know, for various, you know, products and stuff, but with like a big driver in the moving of captive cervids is to set up fake hunting places where you put a deer in a enclosure and pretend to hunt for it. I don't understand. It's kind of like my brother raises lambs on his property, right? And when it's time in the spring to go out, whatever, you go out and shoot the lamb. He doesn't get dressed up in camo clothes and take pictures of the lambs and hang them up on his wall. It's just like a lamb. You like shot a lamb in the pen and you eat the lamb. I don't understand why the guys that are all into shooting penned up deer, why can't they just hunt like lambs or cattle or something? Like, why has it got to be deer? I'll never understand that. But it's all part of this, like, it's part of this facade. You never walk into a guy's house and he's got like a deer. You just kind of like know, you can look and be like, man, that's like a penned up deer. The guy's never, oh yeah, I shot that inside a pen. Ever. Ever. And I've seen a pile of them in a pile of houses. Not one guy. The fence is never in the picture. The fence is never in the story. So if you're so ashamed of it and so bashful about it, why are you engaging it? Just pull out. Stop doing something that embarrasses you so bad. When I'm doing something and I feel embarrassed about it and guilty about it and want to hide it, I generally try to go the other direction. I don't get why it's called hunting. The conservationist Jim Posowitz, he has an explanation for it that I thought was genius, where he was saying, when you hunt penned up deer and sell that, what you're selling, you're actually selling the idea of the wild one. Deer have come to represent wildness. They've come to represent a cultural and economic commitment we've had to their well-being. They've come to represent challenge. They've come to represent struggle. And so when you hang a deer on your wall, you're hanging up a representation of all these ideals. That's what you're selling. When I said like, why deer and why not lambs? Because lambs don't represent challenge and struggle and skill and wildlife legacy. So what you want is you want, I just want the representation. I don't care at all about what it actually means. I know what it'll mean the minute I put it on my wall. And I want to harness that meaning to show it to other individuals so that they think that I value those things when I know secretly that I don't really value them enough to try to achieve it in a legitimate way. I'm just going to buy this thing. It'd be like going out and buying a military uniform and saying, I want a bunch of awards and medals and pins and stuff that I can hang on my military uniform, even though I never served a day in the military. And I'm going to the military parade, bro. And people are going to look at me and think that I'm a hero, a war hero. Now, we all know in our culture how that would go over. But when it comes to hanging, like Pat Durkin, the writer Pat Durkin said, deer make people stupid. That's really kind of the shortest way of putting it. Deer make people stupid.
Stephen Rinella, Giannis Patelis, thank you guys very much for coming to Missouri and spending some time learning a little bit about what we're doing here and experiencing some of the great outdoor opportunities we have. I wish we'd had more time. I'd have loved to got you out on one of the rivers. That's really,
yeah, man, we barely scratched the surface. Yeah. We've been staring at your maps back there, and you know, just on one map, we only maybe hit 10%, 5% of what's available.
Steve, I don't know if we even mentioned that you also got a turkey. So both of you are
going. Oh, yeah. Home. Well, I didn't really. I got a, I found a wounded turkey out in the woods and got him.
But you got a bag of meat. You got a bag of meat.
No, yeah. I absolutely got a turkey. I just didn't get it in the way that people might think. I found a turkey that was wounded. We tried to figure out what happened. There's so many things that could have happened to it. We found a turkey that had a broken wing, and it didn't happen long ago. It hadn't festered. It wasn't, but he had a shattered wing at the first joint away from his shoulder and had a banged up leg. You know, hunting's done at one. We found him at noon and, you know, yeah. Now I got him in the freezer.
This is the first time either one of you have hunted Missouri. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. First time I ever found a crippled turkey and the first time I ever hunted Missouri. And we chased a lot of really healthy birds that were too healthy.
Yeah. Any perspectives, any takeaways from your first trip to the Show Me State?
Oh, loving it, man. I keep waiting, hopefully we get the invite to come back.
It's an open invitation, of course.
Yeah, like, I mean, just, you know, anywhere where it is like that. I mean, you know, some places you go and hunt and you're just constantly feeling like you're bouncing up against the walls, right? Like, oh, I can't go over there, I can't go over here. Even hunting, like you go to hunt a friend's farm, you know, and he's got a couple hundred acres or whatever, and you spend half your time looking at something on the other side of the fence. This spot's nice. I mean, we're kind of coming in from the corner, right? But once you get out in there, you couldn't hunt at all. Not in one turkey season. You know, you could cover out some of it. But yeah, I like that feeling. Just being, man, when you get out their ways and if you hear a gobbler, you know, there's a gobbler going off. You're not like trying to figure out, right? In most directions, you're not trying to figure out if you can go over there or not. You can just kind of go. So that I like that kind of hunting a whole lot. And just running into birds, man, being able to work birds every morning. And there's all the dudes working them too.
Yeah, I think that's part of the joy of it is the fact
it's that part, you know, of the pain and part of the joy.
You know that there's other folks out there loving it as much as you are. So,
oh yeah, in the moment you want to run over there and you don't know if you want to run over there and strangle them or hug them, man, you know what I mean? But it's like, yeah, it's fun. It's like the democracy of, right? It's the democracy of American wildlife, right? You don't have any, the other guys, he goes down to the gas station, buys his license. He's got every same right to it that you do.
Well, man, I could listen to you guys talk for hours and hours, but you got to get to St. Louis, early flight back to Seattle tomorrow. And Giannis, you got a buddy here. You're going to stick around.
I'm going to get a couple more mornings of Missouri turkey hunting in, although I don't have a tag anymore. But
Oh, yeah.
I have a friend from Colorado who's visiting too. He comes down every year. And so, yeah, I'm going to get a couple more.
Who's that? Mornings in.
James Miller.
Jimmy Miller's here?
Yeah.
Oh, man. There's going to be some less turkeys.
Well, safe travels home, guys. Hope to see you back here again.
Thanks, Brandon.